Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. My name is Rebecca Freire, number 20010. I'm a Deputy State Public Defender appearing on behalf of the appellant in this case. Just for the court and counsel's information, I do plan to focus my arguments on the failure to investigate and consult an expert. However, I'm willing to answer any questions the court may have about other areas of the 35C hearing. I think the starting point for any analysis is the Strickland case. And the Strickland case talked about there's not a mechanistic way of applying the two-prong test. It's a fluid test. You have to give deference to counsel's decision at the time, and I don't have a problem with that. You can't look at it in hindsight. With respect to the prejudice prong, however, Strickland is very clear. You have to evaluate counsel's conduct in terms of the totality of the evidence. And if you look at this order, that is where the trial court, what the trial court failed to do. There's no recitation of the trial evidence and how the various allegations of misconduct might have affected the outcome of this case. And I'm going to get more specific with respect to the investigation part of that in just a second. But in terms of the presumption of competence that Strickland says we have to afford trial counsel's decisions, I think in this case, the trial court was not equipped with all the information it needed because trial counsel did not, he was not forthcoming with his disciplinary history. And I think that Rule 3.3 requires candor to the tribunal. 3.3D of 3.3 requires an attorney to disclose material facts, even if they're adverse, that will enable the tribunal, in this case the trial court, to make reasonable decisions. Mr. Cabral knew at the time of that hearing that very similar allegations had been made in the Artolino case and that he'd been found ineffective. He knew his credibility was on the line in this proceeding, yet he failed during his testimony to mention the fact that he was on probation.
Are you suggesting that he did not give truthful answers, or simply that he had the affirmative duty to disclose?
I think he had an affirmative duty to disclose. You know, situations. He was asked pointed questions about his disciplinary history by post-conviction counsel, not by the prosecutor. The prosecutor only asked if he'd been disbarred, and he said no, that was truthful. But he was unable to recall the specifics of any prior discipline, yet admitted he had sustained significant prior discipline. And in fact, if you look at the defense expert's testimony, the defense expert talked about 8 or 9 different instances of prior discipline. 2 of those opinions were actually made part of the record in our attachment A to my opening brief. But he should have told the court, I'm on probation. I've got 60 days hanging over my head. He didn't mention that. A case monitor was ordered to supervise his representation of clients. He didn't disclose that to the court. And yet, post-conviction counsel said, have you been disciplined for prior negligence in cases, prior preparation negligence? His response was, I don't remember. I don't know. I don't have the file in front of me. He should have disclosed that 5 days earlier he had appeared before the disciplinary board and given testimony. He should have disclosed to the trial court that in fact a new complaint alleging negligence in case preparation had been filed a month before the hearing. So I think all of that is relevant to this presumption of competence that the court's required to give under the Strickland analysis and that the trial court just didn't have. With respect to the duty to investigate, Strickland also makes very clear that counsel has a duty to investigate and that the decision not to investigate has to be directly assessed for reasonableness. And in this case, I don't think the trial court did that. We have a case where the defense expert's testimony was uncontested. In fact, the prosecutor was willing to stipulate. Mr. Canny said, when I'm retained on a case, I discuss with my clients the need to retain an investigator. It's not a problem. Mr. Cabral never said that he retained an investigator. Didn't say why he didn't retain an investigator. You can infer, I think, as with the expert, that it was for financial reasons, but he never said why he didn't do it. And the court's order pretty much kind of just follows what the prosecution's pleading says. Mr. Rodriguez testified at the hearing that Mr. Cabral met him in the jail, and at that first meeting in the jail, he said, "These are my witnesses. I didn't do that." That's consistent with someone who's innocent. You give information to your lawyer to go out and to do the investigation. He said he met with Mr. Cabral multiple times asking him to investigate, and Mr. Cabral said, "We're going to win this at motions." And after they didn't win the motions hearing, you're not going to be convicted. And of course, he gave specifics at the hearing about what he asked Mr. Cabral to investigate. He said, "There is a friend of mine, Ricky Castro. There's a co-worker of mine, Lazaro Felix. These two witnesses listened to my voicemail. They heard the victim in this case asking to see me." This isn't hearsay or self-serving hearsay that the court mentions in its order.
In the referring to the voicemail, I wasn't clear in reading the record whether that voicemail was, it could have been part of the law enforcement urging the victim to call in order to gather further evidence.
Absolutely. I think it could have been, but the fact that Mr. Cabral never secured these records to try to support or refute that, I mean, certainly...
Right, that would indicate improper investigation.
Absolutely.
It doesn't add if it's really recordings of pretext telephone calls to the prejudice.
Well, I think what Mr. Rodriguez testified to is that these calls were her asking to, that she wanted to see him. It's my experience that in pretext calls, and I can't specifically remember the trial testimony from the detective about this, I apologize, is that the detective was wanting her to get Mr. Rodriguez to call him. Not necessarily that she wanted to see him, but getting him to answer a telephone call and engage him in conversation. I mean, we had evidence in the record that she is the one that initiated meeting my client, that she had a friend give my client her phone number. This was all before the incident, that she, they had talked and texted numerous times, that she had gone to see him and meet with him in Brighton when he was standing in line to go to a nightclub. So there was a history of her contacting him. That would have been a jury issue. Maybe this was the pretext calls, but that would have been for the jury to decide, and this was a close case. As the prosecutor argued in the 35C hearing, this was a case that rested on credibility, so anything that could have corroborated consent in this case could have probably affected the outcome.
With respect, if we assume that this is deficient representation with respect to the failure to investigate, what is the burden with respect to the prejudice prong? Because we have a situation here where the trial court found that that had not been established.
Well, I don't think that the trial court's finding is really in compliance with Strickland because it didn't discuss that finding in the context of the evidence. The burden here is probably the outcome would have been different, not that he would have been found not guilty at trial. Something less than a preponderance of the evidence, something less than more likely than not. I think if you look at the expert side of it, it's clearly stronger than just these witnesses. But, you know, another thing Mr. Rodriguez testified about was this neighbor. You know, there was somebody who walked by the car when they were having sex in the car. Cabral gave no reason for not hiring an investigator to go out and try to identify which house this person came out of, and Mr. Rodriguez said he saw which house this person came out of to see whether it could have gone anywhere. With respect to the expert, our expert said there was absolutely, because of the nature of the injuries in this case, an absolute requirement that you consult with an expert. Try to determine if those could be explained. Try to get assistance in preparing cross-examination. The trial court's order doesn't address, in fact, the expert report that was introduced by the defense in this case, where this expert, and I think if you look at Koziel's report and his qualifications, and you compare them to Dr. Quackenbush, I think, again, it probably would have affected the outcome. Dr. Quackenbush was an MD, and if you look at his testimony on his qualifications, and that's in the June 15th trial volume at page 23, he had completed 15 to 25 sex assault examinations in his career. He received no special training in sex assault examinations. All of his was on-the-job training, basically how to do a rape kit. He testified, and this was not mentioned in the order either, that these injuries were significant, and in his opinion, having done hundreds to thousands of vaginal exams, not sex assault exams, but vaginal exams, that these injuries stood out as highly significant. Cabral didn't object to that opinion. That was argued by the prosecutor in closing argument, argued all of these significant injuries, and asked the jury, use your common sense.
As I understand it, Cabral did not cross-examine Quackenbush,
no.
Or did he?
No, he did not.
He did not. Right.
He did object to the opinion about whether the injuries were consistent with consent, and the court sustained that objection. We never alleged that that was a problem. That was a good thing to do. What he didn't do and what he didn't explain is why he let this other opinion in. And Koziel's report refutes that other opinion. Koziel had, you know, 29 years of experience as a law enforcement investigator. He had investigated over 200 sex assault cases, and he opined that these injuries weren't inconsistent with an awkward, youthful sexual encounter in a car of that size. Would that have probably affected the outcome? In my view, it would have. That evidence wasn't discussed in the court's order. That evidence wasn't even analyzed in the context of the entire trial record.
You know, you're using, quite correctly, the Strickland prejudice as to whether or not it would affect the outcome. Can you explain to me what confidence that the outcome was fair, what that really means?
Well, Strickland talks about how you have to look at counsel's conduct and whether it undermines the adversarial process such that the trial result can't be relied upon. This is an adversarial proceeding, and the justness is dependent.
But the prejudice, which is the second prong of the Strickland test, It says that the confidence in the outcome, not necessarily that he would have been acquitted.
Right.
And I have tried very hard to understand what that means, that the confidence in the outcome has been undermined.
Well, I think you have to look at the whole evidence. You know, Strickland talks about there being sometimes counsel's conduct in one case might not undermine confidence in the outcome because there's overwhelming evidence of guilt.
Let me ask you this way. Whose confidence? Is it the trial court's confidence? Is it our confidence? Is there an objective standard as to what confidence has been undermined?
Well, I think it's whoever is looking at the case. I think the trial court is one.
Post-conviction. Yeah.
Yes, correct. I think this court has to do that evaluation too, because this court reviews de novo the law and whether the court properly applied the law. And it's my position the court didn't. Because in this case, we don't have overwhelming evidence
of guilt. Well, is that an issue of law, that the confidence has been undermined?
I think it is a legal determination. I think that what this court looks at is whether that particular prong was applied legally or in accordance with Strickland by the trial court. And because the court never mentioned the trial evidence, like Strickland specifically requires, I don't think that, I think that's a problem here.
Let me ask again about establishing prejudice. With respect to the failure to investigate, you indicated that Mr. Rodriguez had told Mr. Cabral that there were various family members he could talk to and so on. To establish prejudice, shouldn't there be a testimony as to what the content of their testimony would have been? Relatives have to come forward and say that at the time of the post-conviction hearing.
Right, and I didn't spend a lot of time about that in my brief because I don't think that the family members issue, Mr. Canny testified that really family member testimony was more relevant to a sentencing issue, to mitigation, not to the trial facts. It was the other witnesses that were relevant to the trial facts.
But what do we know about what they would have testified to?
We know from Mr. Rodriguez what they would have testified to, that they heard these voicemails, that he asked Mr. Cabral to get phone records to corroborate this, and that if you look at the voir dire transcript, the first day of trial, in fact, there's discussion about Rodriguez's phone records because he said that they came late.
Do we know whether the post-conviction court credited the testimony of Mr. Rodriguez?
We really don't, because the court doesn't discuss Mr. Rodriguez's testimony directly. If there are no other questions, I see I've run out of time. Or do I have 57 seconds, or I don't? I don't think
no,
I do.
No, okay. you're
over 57 seconds.
Excuse me. May it please the court, Wendy Ritz, registration number 17024, representing the people in this matter. There's no denying that trial counsel in this case has a lengthy disciplinary history and has had trouble staying on top of his caseload at times, but that didn't make him per se ineffective. The Strickland standard still applies, and the critical inquiry is what happened in this particular case, not trial counsel's conduct in other cases. Here at the evidentiary hearing, the trial court was made well aware of trial counsel's disciplinary history and agreed to consider it in making its determination. The whole issue was hotly contested at this evidentiary hearing. The parties just debated it. I think at the very end, defense counsel tendered what they had as to the disciplinary history. The post-conviction expert talked at length about Ardolino. So none of this stuff was hidden from the trial court. The trial court was made well aware of it and said, okay, I will take this into consideration.
Well, you're not alleging that the fact that the trial court considered, in a limited sense, Cabral's prior history, that was error.
No, I'm just rebutting her suggestion that something was hidden.
Well, what about counsel's suggestion that he was being disingenuous in saying that he didn't recall events that might have taken place within 5 days or
yeah, I think if you review his testimony, I think he was briefly questioned about this by both the prosecutor and defense counsel. I think he truthfully, yet maybe succinctly, responded to the answers. Clearly, the defense knew his disciplinary history and could have probed further. I think at a certain point, the prosecutor objected and said, look, Your Honor, we've debated this, and the court was going to make a decision of what it was going to do with the disciplinary history, but I don't think there's any suggestion that this was concealed. Perhaps trial counsel's answer that he couldn't really remember a particular disciplinary history. I'm not sure what that suggests, except the fact that I know that I often have trouble remembering many things, so I can certainly credit that. And I think that the court was made aware of it.
When you say many things, a disciplinary history to a lawyer is not equivalent to just an offhand.
That's true, issue. Your Honor. And I'm not sure what his answer that he couldn't give the details means. And the fact that he did not disclose an ongoing disciplinary investigation, I'm not sure is an issue either. For one thing, everything that happened as to that took place well after the trial in this case. And I'm not certain would have been something that would have been appropriately weighed as to a conduct at the time of this particular case. There's no doubt the trial court knew about his disciplinary history. Nobody's disputing that he had a number of disciplinary problems, and he didn't dispute it either. He acknowledged it. So I don't think we need to be concerned that the trial court didn't give this appropriate weight. I think the trial court, in fact, mentioned in its order, went through the Strickland standard, and then acknowledged. All that said, I also have to take into account defense counsel's disciplinary history.
Ms. Ritz, I'd like to ask you some questions about the expert. The expert at trial was an important witness for the prosecution. Isn't it a fundamental right to confront witnesses against you?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wouldn't a reasonably prudent practitioner at least voir dire an expert before they sat back and agreed to him being qualified as an expert?
I think he did voir dire the witness.
Well, how can you possibly exercise your right of confrontation if you don't even bother to cross-examine him?
His point of view was that the testimony that Quackenbush gave was essentially limited to these are the injuries and a brief suggestion that out of the cases I've seen, this stands out as a significant injury. When he came to the point of giving the opinion that he was being presented for as to whether this was consistent with consensual sex or non-consensual sex, at that point, trial counsel effectively precluded that opinion.
How can you effectively cross-examine or voir dire an expert if you don't have your own? What questions do you know? How do you know what questions to ask?
But I do not think this was the kind of complex expert testimony that required him to consult with an expert. His testimony at the evidentiary hearing suggested that he reviewed it and he felt it was they were going to be hard-pressed to find a credible expert who could say this was more consistent with consensual sex. And he felt that after discussing with the defendant and his father with limited resources...
But that wasn't the theory of the defense, was it? I mean, the theory of the defense, as far as that expert was concerned, was that it was equivocal. You couldn't tell from the injuries whether or not, and he testified, well, I couldn't have gotten an expert to testify that the injuries indicated consensual.
I think his position was more that he would have had a hard time finding an expert. He felt that he precluded the whole area of inquiry and that before trial he considered this and decided he thought he could effectively deal with it. And I think he did at trial. If you look at the post-conviction crime scene expert's report, it essentially goes through the defendant's recitation of how this sexual assault took place and has a statement about, given the victim's minor injuries, this was consistent with a youthful, awkward sexual encounter. I think his fear was that that getting into this area would just simply open the door to way more discussion of the severity of the victim's injuries than he wanted to get into, because it was much more favorable to the prosecution case.
But isn't that pure guesswork? Because what he's concerned about, according to Cabral's story, is that he was going to be surprised if he cross-examined Quackenbush. But he never talked to Quackenbush before. He couldn't anticipate what Quackenbush was going to say. And he never talked to an expert himself to get some sort of background to adequately cross-examine Quackenbush. And that's why he stated he didn't want to be surprised.
My sense was not that he didn't want to be surprised, but that he felt this was an area that was not fruitful for the defense. To go further into the degree of the victim's injuries, simply, particularly given the victim's discussion of how hard it was for her to walk and her detailed account of how painful this entire process was and how injured she was, it seems that it would not have, I think his pre-trial discussion with the defendant and his father and his review of Quackenbush's testimony and his own experience as an attorney suggested to him that he was better off precluding further inquiry into this as opposed to going further into it.
If we could change focus for a moment, could you comment on the failure to cross-examine the two brothers who had burned the car about the existence of the immunity and the potential effect of his testimony on the sentencing that was still upcoming?
Yeah, as to the immunity issue, it's true, he did not cross-examine the two, Ruben and Raimondo, about the immunity grant. However, the jury was made aware of the immunity grant, both in the prosecutor's opening statement and through Raimondo's discussion prior to his testimony. And trial counsel made the decision to focus on other aspects, the plea agreement and other aspects of his credibility and bias. Given that Ruben had pled guilty already in Denver, He was awaiting sentencing. To some degree, there was limited benefit to him from this immunity agreement, unless he were to withdraw his plea or something. This was a separate prosecution in a separate case in a separate county. This DA had nothing to do with it. And I think that was all laid out on the record by both the prosecutor and defense counsel.
The question is not whether or not his testimony would help him at the sentencing, or even if the immunity grant, if it actually would. Isn't the question what was going through his mind? Did the fact that the sentencing was hanging over it, did he think that currying favor with the prosecution would assist him in minimizing his sentence?
Admittedly, it perhaps would have been better if trial counsel had questioned him in that fashion. However, trial counsel and the prosecutor extensively questioned him about his motives and bias. I would urge the court to read his entire testimony. I think he was very well impeached, and he admitted, I've told three stories, I've lied to the police. He admitted he and the defendant used to be friends, and now he had come to the point where he was having to testify against him. He acknowledged that he had pled guilty. He also at a certain point admitted that he was here testifying because he didn't want to get in trouble and go to jail again. I think the jury got a sense of the entire, was able to effectively assess his credibility. As to Raimondo, his testimony was extremely limited, and the jury heard about, at the start of his testimony, about his grant of immunity. So I think there's not even an issue as to Raimondo.
Was it just said in passing, or how do we know whether a jury would comprehend what that meant, that somebody was going to testify with immunity?
The discussion at the beginning of Raimondo's testimony, I think he got up and essentially said, do I get the Fifth Amendment thing? And I think the court then briefly discussed with the jury what was going on. And he then was told he did get immunity and was to testify. I think that's what the record reflects, something like that order.
Ms. Ritz, would you please comment about the contact of witnesses, the witness list that the defendant gave?
I would be happy to do that, Your Honor. For one thing, I think it's important to note that defendant's testimony as to this pretrial stuff and trial counsel's was in conflict. Trial counsel did not tell me about these two particular people who heard about the voicemail. But more importantly, as the trial court recognized, none of these witnesses had anything to do with the direct encounter between these two people. None of them were there. None of them had any evidence that could impact that actual situation. And the more important thing is, at the 35C hearing, the post-conviction attorneys made no effort to show us what this was. They have a duty, if you look at the case law, to make a showing. The trial court in its order said, they haven't made any offer of proof to me. They could have tracked down these people. They had the names from the defendant. They could have come to us and said, this is what they would say. This is their availability. This is their credibility. This is whether they have criminal background, et cetera, et cetera. None of that happened at the 35C hearing. So that seems to me the defense completely dropped the ball in that area, and as the trial court said, simply did not meet the standard to show. They had some burden to show this, and they simply didn't. All they did was point to the defendant's testimony and say, as the defendant testified at the post-conviction hearing, he had this, 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 and this, but they have made no showing to substantiate how that would have come in and how that would have affected the outcome. So I think the trial court got it right that was not something that went to prejudice. It's important to remember that the trial court who presided, the trial judge who presided at the trial, reviewed the post-conviction motions, reviewed the trial court attorney's conduct, reviewed the applicable law, reviewed the disciplinary history, admittedly found some deficiencies in trial counsel's conduct, but ultimately and correctly realized that the prejudice prong had not been met. Because we need to remember that this was a case with a very compelling victim, and this was a case in which, after the fact, the defendant, with a group of friends, burned his car up, lied to the police about it, and suggested that the real reason he burned his car up was because he wanted to purchase an SUV. This is very compelling evidence corroborating the victim's account of what happened, and I think those are the hurdles that whatever these deficiencies in trial counsel's performance might have been, the prejudice standard simply can't be met. And I think it's also important to remember that unlike the cases in which trial counsel was disciplined, he showed up, he effectively participated in voir dire, he litigated pretrial motions, he had a trial strategy that he coherently presented to the jury. He made all the points that the defendant pointed out about she initiated contact with me, she was flirting with me, she was interested in me. All these points were made and presented to the jury so that the jury was able to make, you know, reach the result that they believed the victim and not the defendant. And I think given the defendant's statements to the police, in which he lied and he had to admit at trial that he lied, Ruben also, his statements corroborated what the victim had to say. I think this was just a case in which there was strong evidence and the trial court's determination was correct that the prejudice prong just was not met here. If there are no further questions, I ask that the court affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ruben.
Go ahead. Let me ask you the question that I asked defense counsel. What is really meant by undermining the confidence in the outcome? Let me hear your position.
While you were talking to her, I was looking at my black letter Strickland law, trying to remember what the exact language is, which is that a defendant must demonstrate when the totality of the circumstances is considered, there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's deficient performance, the result of proceeding would have been different. A reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. It seems somewhat similar to the language we have in sort of our harmless error, plain error standards, in which it seems to be the similar type of language. As to what its exact meaning, I think you have to read it in context and say the defendant has to show that but for counsel's deficient for performance, the result of the proceeding would have been different is the bottom line test.
Then it goes on to say, but the defendant does not have the burden to show but for counsel's errors, he would have been acquitted. So
that's true. But he does have to show that there would have been a different outcome. And I think in the majority of criminal cases, it would have to be something along the lines of he would have been able to be acquitted. There would have been sufficient evidence that a reasonable jury might be able to acquit. And as the trial court reasoned, that showing wasn't made here. Any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Ritz.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Ms. Frayre. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect an opinion to issue in due course.